You're listening to Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on the new FM 1017 and 1320 KLWN.
What's happening, everyone? Derek Johnson in for Nick Schwert, new FM 1017 and 1320 KLWN's Rock Chalk Sports Talk. Nick's out at a wedding, so I guess we just got to sit back here and talk sports. So I guess not very fun for us, right? Well, it wasn't very fun for the Royals today as they blow a lead and lose to the Rockies 3-2, the score. And I mean, if you just sit back, it's frustrating to lose the way they did, blowing the lead in the eighth inning, giving up a two-run home run, not even to one of the Rockies' primary hitters. Like, I mean, it would have stunk anyway to give up a two-run home run in the eighth to Nolan Arenado, but at least you understand it's Nolan Arenado as opposed to Scott Valeika. So they lose 3-2, couldn't really muster up the offense after it was working early. Had a couple other chances where they got leadoff runners on, but couldn't do anything with it, and they fall 3-2. But if you just stand back and look at what they did, they win the series against the Rockies. Considering that yesterday they were down 4-3 in the ninth, down to their last out, and considering that on Tuesday you had Scott Alexander come in out of the bullpen with the bases loaded and work his way out of the jam for the save, I think you'd take the series. I think you'd be fine with winning 2 of 3. And yeah, you can't always approach it that way because, I mean, at some point, like, you need that extra win, especially with the Royals, to where you came into the day half a game back of the Twins and you came into the day 5 games back of the AL Central. Now, Indians still have to play tonight. Of course, that's the big upcoming series for the Royals, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit. The Yankees, who are in the first wild card, are currently down 9-6 with the Tigers, and that one's been just an epic game just because there have been 2 times that the bench is cleared. The first time, there was a legit all-out brawl, and you don't really see that in baseball. Like, Miguel Cabrera and the catcher for the Yankees were going at it. Like, they were throwing punches, tackled each other. The catcher, who still had his catching equipment on, starts gut-punching Miguel Cabrera. It was a wild all-out brawl, and what makes it more interesting, the Yankees catcher who Miguel Cabrera was with in a fight with, his brother is on the Tigers. So that was pretty amazing. And then later on, they clear again because another player got hit. But nonetheless, the Yankees losing in that one. Royals lose this one, as I mentioned, 3-2. Once again, it was Whit Merrifield who was getting things going for the Royals early on. He hit a leadoff home run in the first inning. The first batter hits a solo bomb. Eric Hosmer went 1-for-4, had another good day. Brandon Moss hit a solo home run in the second inning as well, but unable to hold on to the lead. As I mentioned, Scott Valeika with the home run for the Rockies to give them the win in the eighth inning. I wouldn't quite say the way that the Royals lost today took off the luster, though, of last night's game. Again, as I mentioned, with the situations they were in the first game and the second game, even though you blow the lead here in game number 3 of the series, the final game of the series, if you look back on this, I mean, you got to be happy winning the series, winning 2 out of 3. Especially when you consider last night. You're down to your final out, and guess who's closing against you? Greg Holland, who's been very, very good this season. And you know he has something extra to prove, playing in Kauffman, playing in Kansas City, trying to get out Eric Hosmer. But Eric Hosmer did exactly what you expect stars to do. Exactly what you need your team leader to do. Get you out of a rut and win you a ball game. And quite frankly, that's something that he hasn't done before. He's made other clutch plays. Obviously, go back to Game 5 of the World Series, running home, the head-first slide, making it in time. But that's not what I'm talking about. And he's had other games where he's had walk-off hits. He's had other games where he's had walk-off singles, walk-off doubles, where he's had clutch hits to help the team get to that point, where he's had clutch hits to help the team add a cushion to their lead. He's had clutch hits and clutch plays before, but what I mean when we haven't seen that before, we haven't seen him hit a walk-off home run. That was literally his first ever walk-off home run. And it's not to say that, like, okay, to be an all-star or not an all-star, he's been an all-star. To be an absolute bona fide star in the MLB, you have to hit whatever walk-off home runs. Like, it would be silly to sit here and say that. But I think it was something missing, and it's something that you'll notice the Stars not do a ton. You're not going to get a ton of opportunities to hit walk-off home runs anyway. But you see it every so often. That's what the Bryce Harpers, what the Mike Trouts, what those players do so often. And so for that to be the first time for Eric Hosmer, I think it just continues to show the trend of how much he's developed over this season. Everything he's done since his slow start has been adding to his bank account. And if this continues as he leads the team to the playoffs, his price is only going to go up and up and up. And yet it becomes more of a, you've got to re-sign him. Even though the price tag continues to rise, you become more wary of signing him. It really is a double-edged sword. We said this before the season started, like, heck, even a month into the season when he was struggling. I mean, the bright side is that when he was struggling, yeah, well, not going to cost a ton to re-sign him, especially what you would have considered before. But on the downside, do you really want him if he's been that bad? And now we're at the complete opposite front. He's been so good of late. He's been so good since that first month. He's been a bona fide star for this team, keeping them alive in the playoff push, literally winning them the game last night. And he has continued to show development, I think. And the power numbers slightly up. Overall, the statistics slightly up. Batting average, you look at all those things. And then now he's accomplishing first like this. And it's easy to think that Eric Hosmer is, well, he already hit his prime. Because he's been up with the Royals so long, and he's been a contributor on the Royals so long. And he's won games with the Royals, but he's still just 27 years old. Most people hit their prime when they're 26, 27, 28. Goes on until they're about 33, 34. So, I mean, he's just entering his prime. He still has room for improvement, and he's showing that. But as I mentioned, with him showing that, cha-ching, 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 bunch of money getting added to his bank account right now with the way that he's playing. At the end of the day, though, if the Royals are to make the playoffs, they need their stars to step up. It's quite that simple, and chief amongst them is Eric Hosmer. It seems like we're always wondering if there's another level for Hosmer, and he's doing that right now. Like, we all know he's a really good player. He's always had the intangibles. He's been an all-star. He's put up good numbers. But he hasn't had everything come together with a combination of not just good stats, but great stats, and literally making star hitter plays to win a game, i.e. walk-off home runs. Which, again, last night was his first ever one. And, I mean, talk about the irony. Comes off of former Royals closer Greg Holland in the ninth inning with two outs. But everything's coming together. Like, you look at the batting average. This would be his career high. You look at the on-base percentage. Would by far be his career high. You look at the slugging percentage. By far his career high. You look at the OPS, on-base plus slugging. By far his career high. Look at the home runs. Already has his second-best home run total. He's only four off from where he was last year. Doubles. He's going to be right around that mark. Likely have more hits than ever before. Likely will have more runs than ever in his career. So you add all this up, he's taken his good stats to another level to try to push them into great. You add in the fact that he continues to progress. Now he's making plays that you need your superstar to make. Like, that seems to be the biggest thing between being a star and a superstar. Like, you can be a star by putting up good numbers. To be a superstar, you have to come up in the big moments, and you have to make big plays. And Eric Hosmer is taking that to the next level, shown by last night. And I really do think we are seeing the evolution of Hosmer, and he's starting to hit his prime. It's scary from a monetary standpoint, as I mentioned, for the Royals, but it's exactly what you want to see, and it's exactly what the Royals need this year to make the playoffs. Now, along with Hosmer, his big compadre in that game against the Rockies, and he was the guy who got Kansas City started today was Whit Merrifield, who has just been, I mean, he was on fire, then he got a little cold, but seems to be picking things up yet again here. Talking Royals here on New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN's Rock Chalk Sports Talk. So Whit Merrifield goes 4-for-5 in the game yesterday, and that win against the Rockies continues to be a saving grace for this team. They lose the game today, but he hits the home run to lead off the game. And yet with all his success, it continues to be a reminder of what in the hell was the team doing not having him on the roster at season's start. With as bad as Raul Mondesi played, Merrifield was probably worth a win or two in that first month. Doesn't sound like a ton in the grand scheme of things, one win, but guess what? Royals would be leading the second wild card right now. Came into the day half a game back. Of course, now they'd be tied for it after they lose today. In a season where the Royals didn't just sit pat at the trade deadline, they bought and are committing to one last ride. They hope to re-sign some guys for more future rides, but in a year that the Royals are kind of committed to this one last ride motto, they made a decision that was against that by starting a youngster who wasn't ready in Mondesi and not taking the immediately better player in Whit Merrifield, the player who was going to help you more for that one last ride. And now, honestly, it's fair to say that Merrifield probably has a better future than Mondesi. Like, at some point, we need to approach things to where you look at production and go, yeah, you know what, we've seen enough out of this guy and this guy to say that maybe having all these physical tools or just getting hype of being a top-end prospect doesn't necessarily mean you have the better potential to finish out the best career. I mean, if you were to take Whit Merrifield or Raul Mondesi, say, who are you going to take in 2 years? Who are you going to take over the course of the next 3 years? I think you take Whit Merrifield hands down, and I don't even think that's a question. So in a year where they've been about the now, about this one last ride, and of course you'd love to re-sign some of these players and kind of continue that stretch, but ideally this is really the last time you're going to have that whole bunch together, because they're not going to be able to afford Lorenzo Cain, Mike Moustakas, Eric Hosmer, Jason Vargas. They're not going to be able to afford all those guys. Probably won't be able to afford two of them. And they may only re-sign one. I put my money, you get two of them. But in a year where it's been about the now, one of their calls that went against that could be what costs them in the end. And that was not starting Whit Merrifield on the Major League roster. That was starting Raul Mondesi on the Major League roster and having Whit Merrifield in AAA. And this is why we say all the time, like you hear coaches say it, be committed to whatever you're doing. Like, maybe you'll make a mistake, but if you're committed to doing it, if you're going to do it at 100%, you're better off making a mistake being 100% committed than you are tiptoeing around and not being 100% sure where to go. Like, you'll hear it in football. Like, I mean, a head coach wouldn't be happy either way, but he's going to be happier if his linebacker blitzed through the wrong hole but did it full force than he would be if the linebacker was just kind of tiptoeing around, not really knowing where to go, and just kind of hedged his bet a little bit. So in a year that it's been all about the now, and they've committed so much to that, they didn't fully commit at the start. I think they fully committed now. When you buy and make some moves at the trade deadline, and when you've sat Alex Gordon more, and when you have been using Whit Merrifield and haven't called Jorge Soler back up or haven't called Raul Mondesi back up, I think they're there now. But that first month not being fully committed, that might be what costs them. And I don't mean to come across too negative here. They've still got a great shot to make the playoffs. You're only a game back of the Twins for the second wild card. Still got 7 games with the Twins. I mean, we'll see what happens this weekend with the Indians, whether you want to consider them still in the race for the AL Central. 5.5 back right now. We have to wait to see what the Indians do tonight. But if they end up falling out of the wild card race by a game, by two games, man, that's what you're going to look back on. Because with as well as Whit Merrifield's played this year, and as really, really poor as Raul Mondesi was in the majors, that was probably a 1 or 2 win upgrade just over that course of the month. And they'd be sad if they don't make the playoffs because of it. We're going to preview the upcoming schedule, look ahead to it. What do the Royals have to do from here on out? Coming up a little bit later. But coming up next, we talk some Chiefs. You're listening to New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN's Rock Chalk Sports Talk.
1320 KLWN Lawrence and New FM 101.7 K269 GP Lawrence. Depend on it.
520 here, New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN, Rock Chalk Sports Talk. Derek Johnson in, covering for Nick Schwert. He's out at a wedding in Wisconsin. We've got Brian Haney, the voice of the Jayhawks, here in studio today. I couldn't remember if this was the first time we've caught up with you since the Italy trip, but how was it? How was going out to Italy?
It was incredible, Derek, and thanks so much for having me, buddy. I really appreciate it. You know, the team had a chance to do so much away from the basketball court, and that's really a great example of the first-class experience that the University of Kansas and the KU Athletic Department affords its players. They lined up so much extra stuff that you could possibly squeeze into 3 days around the basketball that we had there, from a tour of the Sistine Chapel to a chance to see the Colosseum to Lake Como, which is one of the most beautiful places in the world. George Clooney has a house there. John Legend, one of your favorites, was married there. I mean, it was a little slice of heaven. It was so beautiful out there. And on top of all of that, had a private showing of The Last Supper, something that you have to be on a wait list for 3 or 4 months to get to see. And the thing is, if you or I went back there today, we would never get to see it through the vantage point these guys got to see it. And so tip of the cap to Dr. Zanger, Sean Lester, everybody with KU Athletics that helped to coordinate this trip, because they gave our players, coaches, and staff the trip of a lifetime and a first-class experience unlike any I ever could have imagined.
I think Bill Self said it, like he was just amazed by how much history there is out there. Was there one thing that you enjoyed more than the others?
Yeah, I think, honestly, The Last Supper was so cool to get to go from the Sistine Chapel experience, which is a more impressive painting because it spans an entire ceiling, right, but you're packed in there with 300 other folks, and you're not supposed to take flash photography, you're not supposed to talk, but everybody's talking, and it's crowded, and there's BO, and it's just not fun, to then having this private showcase of The Last Supper, where we're as close to the painting as I am to you. We're allowed to take pictures. They got us in there for an extended amount of time, and it's kind of cool. They don't allow any foreign air to get in there. So there's a sliding glass door that you go in, and then a sliding glass door on the opposite side that you go out, and those two doors are never open at the same time, so they keep it contained in there. We have guys like me with a lot of hot air in their system that I'm sure clogged it up a bit, but we had a good time, and it was really neat that they did that for the guys to have a chance to see that like they did. But probably the most fun day the team had, and I would hop on board with this, was the lake tour of Lake Como. It was a big boat cruise with an afternoon spin on the Bellagio Island out there. Some of the best Italian I had the entire trip I got that day at Bellagio. And I think the guys at that point, the hay was in the barn on the basketball. We played all 4 games, and it was just time to kick back and relax and have some fellowship and some bonding. And I think for the players and the boosters and the coaches alike, that would probably be a unanimous favorite day for everybody.
Was there one food that you ate more than the others? I went out to Italy when I was about 13 years old. I think I had gelato twice a day.
You have to, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I had 3 rounds of gelato, a lot of rigatoni, 2 rounds of lasagna, tried pizza several times. I realize that sounds unoriginal, but hey, man, you got to do it the Italian way. It's much different than what we get back here. So I definitely spread it around, and I probably put on 4 or 5 pounds in the 9 days we were over there, because we call these games at, till 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, have an hour bus ride back to Rome or Milan from where we were playing, and then you finally get a chance to go out to eat at midnight. So putting on all those carbs at the wee hours in the morning was probably not a good thing for a 37-year-old waistline.
You know, 4 to 5 pounds, though, for a trip in Italy isn't that bad. I'm sure people have done worse. I also saw the rapping video.
Yeah, that was unexpected. Well, you didn't see a video, did you? You saw an article.
Yes.
Okay. If there's a video out there, I need to see who that's coming from. But I learned my lesson, and I love Matt Tate. He's terrific and one of the most talented guys we have a chance to be around. But if you're in the presence of writers, you need to be aware of what you say at all times, because even the most candid and unintended to be recorded moments have a chance to be on the record.
I don't do that here. We just let the people hear it, and they can
exactly
do what they want here. In terms of the games, I'm sure it was incredibly hot for you from a broadcasting standpoint, like 100 degrees in the gym.
Unbelievably hot, yeah.
How much do you think that affected the team? I mean, there were a lot of turnovers in the games, but, I mean, I don't know if your hands get sweaty, the ball gets a little slippier.
Yeah. You know, it's a good question, and honestly, the players had it a little bit better than we did, because they sat on benches with some open-air doors and windows behind them, and then Coach Self, very smart on his part, takes them outside and sits under a shade tree for halftime. And I'm not kidding, okay? That's how you get in the Hall of Fame. You know, real common sense moves like that, right? And then the second venue we went to was even hotter than the first, because there was just no circulating airflow at all. And some of the fans even kind of stood outside and watched from the door in just to get some kind of breeze. But it was a factor. A coach knew that heading in. They told us while we were there it was the second hottest summer in the last 150 years in Italy, right when we were there.
Of course.
And of course, you're playing in these high school gyms that don't have any air conditioning or, you know, any normal amenities that we'd be used to having. But I sound spoiled saying that. We had a blast, and yeah, we led the league in pit stains while we were there and had to towel off at every mid-quarter break that we took. But that was kind of fun. It was a good bonding experience for the broadcasters too. Gurley had to run and fetch towels for us and make sure we didn't drip on the gear too much.
Were there any big takeaways for you from the basketball court?
I think so, but I think the takeaways came more from the 10 practices before we went over there. And that's not to sound disparaging about the basketball competition we were up against, but I think you learn more over a larger sample size against each other than you do in some of these hot, sweaty gyms where nobody's playing more than 25 minutes a game, and you're taking on teams that, the first team's case, they were mostly 17, 18-year-olds, and then you played a group of average-age 26-year-olds by the end of it, but they weren't a whole lot better. So to me, the observations I had, and this is just one man's opinion, Coach Self might tell you different, but I think most of us would agree, LeGerald's had a terrific summer. He looked really good in the practices, was maybe the most consistent performer, at least of the six practices I saw out of 10. He was the most consistent. And then you'll notice from the box scores, he didn't do a whole lot the first couple of games. And prior to game three, Coach Self said, hey, I want you to be more assertive, more aggressive with the ball. He averaged over 20 a game the last two games of the trip. And I think he's kind of kicked it into an extra gear and dialed it up an extra notch in terms of his court confidence, aggressiveness, this is my time type thing. And make no mistake, he still realizes this is Devontae's team and Malik's a great second option. And on many nights, Derek, Malik will be option number one, as we saw in game four over there. But LeGerald realizes he has a chance to really shine in what should be the best backcourt in America, certainly the best guard quartet in America. When you put Devontae, Svi, the likes of Malik Newman and now LeGerald Vick all together, I mean, these guys are phenomenal. And they're all veteran players. You know, Malik has a sophomore distinction next to his name, but that's a 21-year-old kid that's now in his third year removed from high school. Same with LeGerald Vick. Svi, younger guy for his age, but he's a fourth-year collegian. Devontae, older guy for his age, and he's a fourth-year collegian. So to have all that experience, all that maturity, and just oodles and oodles of talent, those four guards are going to take this team as far as it goes this year, and I challenge you to find a group of four that even comes close.
We're talking with Brian Haney, the voice of the Jayhawks here, New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN's Rock Chalk Sports Talk. Football starts in 9 days here.
Yeah.
I know you're excited for the countdown, excited for this season upcoming. You got any nicknames planned? I know last year we had Speedy Gonzalez. Obviously, that's not going to transfer over this year.
Yeah.
Anybody planned out anything you've heard from the team?
You know, and I didn't come up with Speedy Gonzalez. They actually told me that was Laquiviante Gonzalez's nickname at his previous stop at Texas A&M. But haven't worked on a ton. I do have one. It's funny you should ask. People probably think this is like a TV talk show where we rehearse the questions ahead of time like they do on Jimmy Fallon or something. Not at all.
You rolled in here 5 minutes before you came on. You got your nice blue truck.
Yeah I'm sweating from the gym. Yeah, we didn't prep this at all. But you kind of just walked into something that maybe I can try out on the Rock Chalk Sports Talk audience.
Let's do it.
And see what they think. So we've got this speedy receiver return man freshman that David Beatty's been talking about a lot. Where's number six? If you've been listening to any of the training camp audio, the name Quan Hampton has come up time and time again. Now, it's a deep position that he's trying to crack into the rotation of when you've got guys like Sims and Booker, and been hearing a lot about Shadler and Patrick, and obviously you got a guy like Daylon Charlotte coming over from Alabama. He's going to steal a lot of targets and looks as well. But Quan Hampton just keeps jumping off the page. So I was thinking about the name Quan. Where have I heard Quan before? Do you know where I'm going with this?
Are you going to the song?
No.
Okay.
There's a song about Quan?
Yeah, Do the Quan.
Do the Quan. Oh, see, you're more hip than I am. My generation, those of us, raise your hand, born in the 1980s or late 1970s, we love the movie Jerry Maguire. Show me the money, Jerry. Rod Tidwell, Arizona Cardinals receiver, right? And he always talked about he wanted Quan. And if Jerry could get him his contract extension and that max deal he was wanting from the Arizona Cardinals, Jerry would be his ambassador of Quan.
There you go.
So at some point this season, when he gets in the end zone, Quan Hampton will become the ambassador of Quan. I got to find a way to weave it in just right so it comes off the tongue just right. But the ambassador of Quan, if you don't know what I'm talking about, Derek, because you're too young.
No, I love the movie that this movie. Weekend. Jerry Maguire, great movie.
Fantastic movie. Mm-hmm. Who's coming with me?
I'm going.
Show me the money. Remember he held the goldfish in the air?
He's
Who's
got
coming
the
goldfish, with
you, man? Yep. Turns into more of a romance at the end, but
you had
still
me
a very
hello.
Good movie. Yes.
And we also learned in that movie from the little kid that the human head, the average human head weighs 8 pounds. All kinds of quotable lines, including
They're
the ambassador
very,
of Quan.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't
great
expect to talk
movie.
About that today.
It's a great date movie, too, because you can sell your girl on a romance, but then you get your sports action involved. Just great movie all around. So many people are coming back to Lawrence for this opener.
Yeah.
Obviously, Mangino's coming back. That's probably the big one. But then you have Tlaib and Collins getting inducted. You have Todd Reesing as well. Is there anyone that you're specifically excited to see coming back at the home opener?
I think it's a really big deal to have Aqib Tlaib coming back because, I mean, this is a guy that has become a perennial Pro Bowl caliber player. And he still embraces the time that he had here at KU, a proud Jayhawk. And to have not one but two Pro Bowlers in that same secondary, Chris Harris as well. It's such a great story. And, Darrell Stuckey's gone on to be a Pro Bowler with the San Diego Chargers one season. He was runner-up for NFL Man of the Year. We got a lot of guys to be proud of from that team in the league. And I know James McClinton's coming back. He's had a fruitful career in the Arena Football League. And obviously a guy that if he was just born 3 inches taller, he would have been playing on Sundays his whole career because nobody had a motor like James McClinton. So there's a lot of guys I'm fired up about. But Aqib, we went 15 years between first-round picks at KU. Dana Stubblefield to Aqib Tlaib. Stubblefield at one point was the NFL Defensive Player of the Year. The career didn't finish as great as it started, but Aqib has given Kansas, not just him, but primarily him, that brand name in the NFL where on Monday Night Football when you're showing the starting lineups and you see the guys' faces and they say where they're from and all that. I mean, that's a Pro Bowler you could be excited about, along with Harris and Stuckey too. And who knows how the career goes on for him. I'm not saying he's a Hall of Famer or anything like that just yet, but in his generation, I think you would agree with me, he's been a top five cover corner during his prime years. In a stretch of years where you've had some pretty good ones. Josh Norman comes to mind, most notably of late. There have been a lot of really good guys
Darrell Revis.
His era. Darrell Revis, yeah, absolutely. When he was with the Jets and the one season with the Patriots, Revis Island, man.
Mm-hmm.
But Aqib Tlaib, whether it was with the Bucs, where he picked off Peyton Manning as a rookie, or with the Patriots, with the Broncos, he's found a way to be one of the top five guys in the league. And I think it's a special legacy he's carving out for himself.
So if you were to pick anybody off of that 07 team, because there's going to be more, I would imagine, that get into the Ring of Honor, the Hall of Fame, beyond Collins and Tlaib, because they're going up this year. Who would be your next pick? We did a poll on this on RCST, and
yeah.
I'm sure you can guess who the winner was.
Well, I mean, it has to be the Todd father.
Yeah.
He rewrote every
Sparky.
Passing record
yep.
in the book. It's interesting. So, too, did Desmond Briscoe and Kerry Meyer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard now to look at stats because in the modern-day era of spread it out, spread it around, air it out, I mean, the catch numbers are off the charts. Mm-hmm. These guys did things in one season that would have been a top 10 career type number prior to that. And so, it's hard to debate, okay, where do the numbers stack up since guys like an Isaac Byrd or something, if he would have played in that era, maybe he has some comparable numbers, but he didn't get the number of targets or touches a game that they got. Having said that, Kerry Meyer and Desmond Briscoe, statistically speaking, are two of the absolute best players this program's ever seen. Todd Reesing is too. You know, there's a lot of guys that deserve some recognition. But if you go off criteria of All-American distinction, which is what we're talking about here with Akib and Anthony Collins, I see why those guys are there. And I think Todd has to go up because, you know, really it was Sparky that sparked the high watermark in this program's history. And hard to believe it's been 10 years. In some ways it feels longer than that. In other ways it feels shorter. But I'm glad to know our current football coach is having this arrow pointed upward to where we can get back to the bowl eligibility days and back to playing in December and competing for much, much more than what we've seen in previous regimes where you were hoping for moral victories and trying to eke one or two out.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Brian Haney here, New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. I think one of the other distinctions they should make, and this isn't something that's in the rules, can you tell the story? They talk about this in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Can you tell the story of this program without this player? And I don't think you can do that without Todd Reesing. Can you tell the story of the Kansas program without Todd Reesing? I don't think you can.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point, Derek. The story of the Kansas program without Todd Reesing is that, well, Mark Mangino takes him to a bowl game for the first time in 7 or 8 years. I guess it would have been 8 years in the Tangerine Bowl with Bill Whittemore. Goes back with Jason Swanson in 2005 to the Fort Worth Bowl. You know, you had Kale Pick in there. You had Kerry Meyer, who we thought was going to be a quarterback, ended up being a prolific receiver. But they didn't have anybody truly click for a sustained stretch. Those other guys were short-term guys, a couple of years, JC guys, that kind of thing. I think the tale of the Kansas program without Todd Reesing would have been one or two more bowls, but certainly not a BCS bowl, certainly not a 12-1 season, certainly not a Sports Illustrated cover, nothing like that. But he would have found a way to slap something together to get you back to a 7-5, 6-6 type year. But when you had Reesing bring it all together and everything clicked, the year his touchdown interception ratio was something ridiculous like 36-4. And you had Bill Young orchestrating a defense that had some big time playmakers on it too. It's not just about the quarterback position, right, but certainly that carries a lot of weight. But it all kind of came together. And it's amazing how everybody buys in when you've got a playmaker that can truly make magic happen under center. And that's what we had in number five.
Well, and you talked about how the stats, I mean, they get blown up with the spread offenses now. But what's amazing since we've had Reesing, and maybe that's part of the reason why the quarterback play has seemed even worse off than it has been since Reesing has departed, although looking up this year, it just seems like there hasn't been any stability there. And I don't know if that's a question where the stability breathes the production or the production breathes the stability. It's kind of a chicken and egg situation. But, I mean, whatever happens this year, you'd hope it's stability and you hope it's production. But if you look at some of, like, the all-time records, some of the all-time single-season records, if Carter Stanley or Peyton Bender, whoever starts this year, goes out, throws for 2,000 yards, which I think would be a pretty good number. I mean, a pretty good baseline number. If you're getting 150 yards a game, that seems pretty reasonable. 160 yards a game in the air raid offense, you'd be in the top 10 all time for single season passing yards at KU. I mean, it hasn't been done though since Reesing, but how sustainable is that, do you think, for this year's group of quarterbacks?
If they stay healthy, that I would expect 250 a game. I think in this offense, which isn't a huge transition from what we saw a year ago. In fact, not at all. The principles are very similar with what Doug Meacham's going to do compared to what David Beatty installed with his version of the air raid a year ago. With this offense, the playmakers they have, good pass protection up front. I spent about 30 minutes today with Zach Yenser, our O-line coach, and he is jacked, man. He is so excited. You know, I think clearly Akeem Adeniji has a chance to be an all-conference guy before his career is done. He's just a sophomore. Mesa Ribert, he's made huge strides. Center. You know, we got a five-star guy from Alabama that's not necessarily going to be a starter at right tackle right now. We'll see what pans out at that right tackle spot, if Baldwin wins the job or not. But, I mean, that's how hotly contested things have been up front for KU, and I think they feel like they've got better depth than they've had in a long time in the trenches. So you're going to have good pass protection. We just ran through all those receivers a second ago. Steven Sims has a chance to be a top five or six guy in the league, in the Big 12 Conference, that is. And then you've got, obviously, Charlotte, a playmaker from Alabama that many expect big things from. I think you'll see the slot receivers, whether it's Patrick or Shadler, making plays. I think Ben Johnson, if they make the H-back tight end more of a focal point, he's really dedicated and rededicated himself to put himself in a position to have a big, big season and a swan song here at KU. So I'm excited for him. But you add it all up, and I think if you have one guy with some continuity and some success with what Meacham is going to do in zinging that ball around and taking some shots downfield, very realistic to expect 240, 250 through the air per game. Question is, you know, do you need both quarterbacks over the course of the year? Because inevitably something happens, whether it's injury or ineffectiveness or something else. And the good news is they feel significantly better about the quality and the quantity of what they have in terms of QB1 on this day compared to 2016 at this time, when you had Willis and Cozart, but you didn't have the upside, the ceiling, and some of the intangibles that I think these two are going to bring to the fold in Peyton Bender and Carter Stanley.
You brought up Doug Meacham. How do you think all these pieces fit together for him? How much of an impact can he have as an offensive coordinator?
I think he's excited, and you're going to love this guy. You know, when he first took the job, I called Brian Estridge, who's the voice of the Horned Frogs at TCU, and I said, tell me about him. What's he like? He said, oh, man, this guy's an adrenaline junkie. He's jumping out of airplanes. He's doing bungee cord jumping. He's going wakeboarding. He's nuts. And you see this guy who's, you know, got a family and a very responsible guy, but at the same time, likes to have a good time. He kind of looks like Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah.
He's got that long hair. He's always running around high energy or whatever. And I think some of that kind of translates not only into his energy on the practice field, but his play calling up in the booth. He's going to take some chances. He's going to be creative. He's got some stuff up his sleeve that he's excited to uncork. And I think he was, I don't want to say pleasantly surprised with what he inherited here, because he saw Kansas up close a year ago and he knew a little bit about what he'd be working with Sims at receiver and some of the options they had at running back, even with Keon Kinner moving on. But I think once he got in here and had a chance to work with Peyton and see how much Carter Stanley had improved, because keep in mind, Carter wasn't the quarterback when TCU coulda, shoulda, woulda got upset here a year ago. In fact, with all due respect to Ryan Willis, if Carter's the QB there on a play they missed, David Beatty would tell you this. In fact, he pointed this out on Hawk Talk, so this isn't Brian Haney talking. This is David Beatty. They had a chance on a play that Willis just flat out didn't see inside the final minute on a wide receiver. I don't know if it was a post or if it was a slant, but he broke open and there wasn't a frog within 20 feet. And Carter has some vision and has just an attention to detail that I think if he was inserted in that spot at that juncture, might have made the play. And so I tell you that not to have buyer's remorse on who we were playing at quarterback at that time or having a shoulda, coulda, woulda mentality, but to say that we are so much better off a year later because Carter did get his chance and he proved he was worthy of more of them. And he's been pushed hard by Peyton Bender throughout the spring, and he's pushed right back. You know, a lot of guys that get recruited over them, like many would say Kansas did with Peyton Bender to Carter Stanley, you know, might have packed up their gear, put their tail between their legs, and taken their ball and gone home. He didn't, and he's been ultra competitive throughout the camp. And as David Beatty has said a couple of times now, they're probably not going to announce a starter until whoever runs out there on Saturday night the second, because it doesn't help their cause any to tip their hand. But whoever it is, you feel significantly more comfortable and confident with the sum of what you have at that position, the sum of those two parts together, than maybe what you had a year ago. And I'm a big Montel Cozart fan, but I think in this case, it's absolutely a better off situation in 2017.
That story about Carter Stanley is pretty amazing, because if you think of the repercussions, I mean, beyond giving Kansas another win, beyond giving them two in the Big 12, I mean, if Carter Stanley wins that game for you, he wins two Big 12 games in his freshman season, there's probably not a quarterback competition right now. Like, for all we know, they may not even recruit Peyton Bender.
That's an interesting point. You know, I think you always try to take a quarterback if you can get him. It's something you stockpile, like you with running backs in your fantasy league. But I think you make a good point. And yet he wasn't moving up the depth chart at that juncture. I tell you that story because I think the quarterback who was in there at the time, sometimes he would lock in or his eyes wouldn't make the progression.
I think he had three interceptions that game.
Yeah, and again, we're not trying to,
right,
you know, dig up old wounds from the past, but I think Carter gives you a chance to make some plays, and I think he reads and takes what's there to be taken a little bit better than maybe what you had at that juncture a year ago. Because quite frankly, you know, the first part of the season when they were going back and forth between the two quarterbacks a year ago, Montel, I think Coach Beatty would tell you, was making better reads and trying to deliver the ball where it should go based on the coverage and based on what was available. He just didn't always execute it. Whereas I think Willis tried to force things that weren't there and maybe had a higher chance of executing the pass, but it wasn't going where it should have gone. Why am I talking about all this? Because I think you got a couple of guys that not only read but can execute it, and that should make a market improvement and difference a year later.
He's Brian Haney, voice of the Jayhawks. He'll be on the call in 9 days.
That's right.
KU takes on Southeast Missouri State, and you can hear it right here, New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
The ambassador of Quan. Well, we get to hear it in week one. I hope so. Quan Hampton coming to a football stadium near you.
He'll have a great chance to do it against Southeast Missouri State. That's Brian Haney. Thanks so much for coming in studio today.
Always good to see you, Derek. One of my favorite young guys in the business. Thanks a lot.
All right, we'll wrap up the show on the other side.